I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University. Welcome back, Martin.
It's great to be here, Michael.
I suppose I'm the one who should be welcomed back. I've been having cultural fun in Sydney and with the Vignerons in the McLaren Vale in South Australia and eating long degustation meals, Martin, but here I am back, welcomed by nearly 14 millimetres of rain in Frio overnight. The place is the subject of a deluge, which makes me think that this is exactly when the political pipe dreamers close the doors, get out a nice hot cocoa, and start to think about what's going on. We've got the new Community Strong Party launched. We've got in Western Australia an astounding development. Jonathan Huston, the Liberal Party MLA for the very conservative seat of Nedlands, jumping ship. And I'm not sure whether he's thinking he might join One Nation or whether he might, in fact, run off and join the Community Strong Party, Martin. But I'm thinking all of the parties must be wondering just where they are at the moment. Even the Labor Party is thinking about voters that sort of put through some tax reforms. What are you
Might
making of
be
it
the time
all?
for a stock take, Michael.
I think it is time for a stock take. I mean, what do you make of it all? What do you think they're dreaming?
Well, let's go through a few of the parties. I think, firstly, Labor Party in government. Labor Party has been a little bit insulated from the rise of One Nation because it started by expanding its base and soaking up a lot of conservative voters. And that probably was seen as a good thing by people in the Labor Party who saw the conservative politics divided. But what we're starting to see in the polls now is they're starting to eat into the Labor vote. So suddenly, Labor's got to stand up and take notice and start to put some thinking and strategy into how they repel the One Nation tsunami. And so I'd expect that you're going to see One Nation get attacked a lot more by Labor coming up over the next 12 to 18 months as they seek to shore up themselves. They've got a natural spot that's separate from One Nation in that they're on the left. But they don't want to go the way that Labor Party in Britain's gone, where they've just lost another PM, Keir Starmer, who's only elected 2 years ago. And reform, which is probably the closest equivalent to One Nation's, outpolling them by a mile. So I think there's some danger signs unless they probably pivot and talk more about some of the economic things which are underpinning One Nation's rise.
Martin, most of us have grown up learning about broad churches, whether it be the Liberal Party. I think the Nats, the Country Party, all went to the same Country Party church. Not so many broadnesses in there. But the Labor Party, of course, it's always had its sort of centre, its left, including its mad left, its right, including its mad right. Will there be some new ascendancy within these sort of churchy arrangements, do you think, in the Labor Party?
The one thing the Labor Party has as an asset in Australia is it's the political wing of the union movement. And people critique it in certain ways because of that. But in times like this, that's where the union movement can help because the union movement still represents somewhere around 18 to 20% of the workforce. So that's a pretty big representation. And they've always been well organised and they've always been pretty good at campaigning. So if the trade unions that support Labor can rally a lot of people to stick with the Labor project, then at least they've got that. Now, if we talk about the Liberal Party, Michael, they're in a much bigger mess, because they've already had a lot of their base eroded by One Nation. They're stuck between, say, the loss of seats to the Teals and the cities, and then One Nation smashing them in the homeland. And you saw in Farah where they end up a distant third there. So they're in a real mess. And you saw Angus Taylor recently that was bit like a rabbit in the headlights when asked about multiculturalism. I mean, that was astonishing. He couldn't really give a straight answer. That shows the dilemma that they're facing. He's got to get his story right, he's got to get his strategy right, and they've got to really latch on. They haven't really made a lot of this budget, Michael, that a lot of people have been unhappy about it, and a lot of media, which have really got stuck in the government on it. But the Liberals still haven't got traction out of it, Michael, which is a pretty dangerous sign, I think.
I like the description of that interview with Angus Taylor as a rabbit caught in the headlines. I mean, you'd think somebody, one of his junior staffers, might have said to him, Angus, multiculturalism. Yeah, why are you asking me? You're going to be asked a question about multiculturalism. Are you ready for it? What's the answer? What answer should I give? It's a damn good thing. Yep, we love it. And get on with
Yeah.
the interview.
I think it was a point of it was an obvious point of differentiation with One Nation, because Pauline Hanson herself has gone into a mess in trying to describe what she likes and dislikes about multiculturalism, or what she calls monoculturalism. Because you tried to say the Socceroos were good. I'm not sure that she properly understands at least the traditional definition of multiculturalism, which is where a whole range of cultures, people bring their cultures to the table. And that's part of, I think, what the Socceroos represent. But anyway, it was kind of astonishing, given that that's such a hot button issue, that there wasn't a ready talking point sitting there for him.
Well, we're busily not talking about the Greens. They've just showed themselves to be politically relevant again, Martin, by agreeing to the tax reforms that have just gone or going through the Parliament. Jim Chalmers seems to have pruned back a whole lot of concerns that people have had. The Greens picked them up. Are the Greens sort of rapidly disappearing from sight when they pull out the pipe and start dreaming about the next 18 months or so? What will they be dreaming?
I think to date they missed an opportunity. That doesn't mean they couldn't change. But if you look at the mayor of New York, who's astoundingly popular where he is, and he's running candidates in New York. Now, that's only in a very liberal area, right, of US. But he's run on an economic left platform. So a form of left-wing populism, if you like, right? I think that there's an opportunity there, because people are genuinely unhappy, feeling disenfranchised, etc. If they can pivot more to those sorts of issues, those sorts of bread and butter issues, people are willing to consider new ideas if the system's broke. I think that's where the opportunity is, if they can grasp it.
Well, out of all of this, sort of driven by it in part, but also by political financing law changes, we have the new Community Strong Party, the CS Party, Martin. I suppose we shouldn't have been surprised about this, but nonetheless, it's there and it's only got two members at the minute.
I'm a little bit skeptical, Michael, in that I don't think straight centrist parties have had a strong history. You remember the Democrats, which is the closest attempt here. They tend to get wedged between other parties, and it also undermines the core strength of the community independents, in that they were independent. And as soon as you lose that, you're then hitched to policy positions of other people. I noticed that most of those teal independents have not joined this party, and I think that's where their wariness comes in. So if you're someone like Kate Chaney in Western Australia, you've got a particular electorate, you're in a particular state that has its own policy priorities. You don't want to be wedded to what's going on in inner city Sydney or inner city Melbourne. And even in inner city Sydney, you've got someone like Wentworth, which is a high Jewish population, that's quite different in makeup to some of the other inner city areas, and some different political priorities because of that. So I'm not convinced that it's a really good move for those independents long term myself.
Well, you're Zali Stengel and Allegra Spender, who are the two founding members. They're not going to have members of the party as such. They're the people who, in a sense, run it or are identified with it. And they're both from Sydney. Is there something special about the Sydney setting, apart from Malcolm Turnbull having thought this was all a good idea, and he's a Sydney fella?
Oh, I mean, the Teals have done pretty well in Sydney overall, and it was the only place where they picked up another seat at the last election. So, maybe they're seeing an opportunity there. But you've also got to wonder, are they going to compete directly against Teal-like independents? because that's the natural seats, right, for them to stand. And then they'll just split the vote further. So, they've got to go out and then hunt in other grounds where they don't hold seats. So I think it's mostly an upper house bid, I think, Detroit lands and candidates there.
Now that's interesting, Martin. Explain that to our listeners, an upper house bit. You think they see the real force in Australian politics is the Senate?
Yeah, I think that if you can get seats in the Senate is almost always a hung parliament. That for people less attuned to politics, that means that almost always your vote really matters when it comes to passing legislation. And if they were to get a couple of candidates up, now New South Wales is actually one of the hardest places to get a candidate like that up because the electorate's so big and they don't elect minor parties so frequently. But Tasmania does. Some of the other states like Victoria and South Australia, you could have a chance. So it's not unreasonable for them to try and aspire to a Senate seat.
You're right about Tasmania in particular. There's quite a strong and historic independent movement and group of candidates in the existing Tasmanian State Parliament, Martin.
There is indeed. And for if the, you know, the purpose of a party is you build your brand, if they got candidates up for state elections, absolutely. New South Wales is ripe for the picking in the upper house for a state-based candidate because it's all proportional voting, so it's pretty easy to get elected to that house.
I suppose the best thing, when all said and done, that the community strong party having been formed could do is to really say, look, we're just here because of the tax implications, the financing implications of campaigning. If we're a party, we're probably going to get more money and it's a more even playing field. And that's what we've always been on about, and that's what we're still on about. So don't get confused by us being a party.
Well, it could. I just think it's a bit hard trying to sell different things. If your brand is an independent brand and you're trying to sell a party, you end up somewhat confusing your. And some of the critics of the Teals is that they're all, because they're all funded by Simon Holmes, of course, and climate, the same funding initiative, then because of that, they're all the same. I think that's overlooking a fair bit of nuance there. You are playing into your critics.
Well, some way or the other, the aforementioned Country Party, oops, National Party of Australia, is sort of getting out scot-free. They're pottering around the place and no one's putting much of a look on them. No one's asked their leader, Matt Canavan, what he thinks about multiculturalism, I don't think. What are they pipe dreaming about at this point? Do they just want to silently sneak through it all and hold their seats at the next election?
I think that they're probably the party under the most threat still, Michael. We talked about how challenging it is for the Liberal Party, but One Nation's strongest voting record consistently to date has been in country and regional areas. So they've got some real work to do. I'd be quite nervous if I was a head honcho in the National Party. And the fact that no one's asking them these questions is not a good thing, Michael. Probably that they're still struggling for relevance. They've got, their message is outside the usual city centre and outside the, Canberra media bubble and whatever else, and they'll tell you that. But they've still got I still think they've got a lot of work to do to get themselves re-elected because they're right in the firing line.
Now, if you consider One Nation to be the cat that has landed amongst the pigeons, Martin, the political parties of Australia, and caused them all to sort of scatter and bump into each other and run this way and yelp and so on, what will One Nation be dreaming? What will they be aiming to do? What will their hope be between now and the next election?
Well, I think they're going to get more and more ambitious. I'd expect them to run candidates in practically every seat. If they're smart, they do need to target seats. Their best chance, I've just said, is in regional and country areas. That's where they poll well, but they'll have a red hot crack at out of suburban areas as well. And that's where Labor will be nervous. Look, if their polling stuck, they would be the official opposition, you would say. And they're absolutely in the hunt for 30, 40, even 50 seats in the Commonwealth Parliament at this rate.
It's
No, of course, there's a long way to go.
there's a long way to go. Don't get sort of too excited. But I suppose that's exactly the sort of thinking that the honchos, the people who aren't standing for election, but sort of provide intellectual support for all the parties. But in One Nation, we'll be saying, "But a long way to go." It's like the football season, Martin.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So I think that's where what they'll be clinging to. And there's a fair bit of strategy involved because One Nation's biggest problems has been sourcing and retaining quality candidates and doing their due diligence on them. And probably the last thing they want is to find out they've pre-selected some neo-Nazis, Michael, or something of that ilk. So, I think even in South Australia, there was one or two candidates that were really dodgy backgrounds, etc. It's pretty hard to suddenly find around 200 people out of the blue to stand for your party. And that's the challenge they face.
I used to love watching The Good Wife, American television series, very political, a very flawed politician, all set in Chicago. But when someone stood, sort of vetting process they put them through, forget about sort of marital infidelities, like sort of also checking out how many traffic fines they'd had and everything else, I think, Martin. And I expect we'll be seeing a bit more of that in Australia. When, the Teals have succeeded because of the quality of the candidates that they've been able to bring into the system. And you'd think all of the parties would be wanting to learn from that. But you want real people with skill and capacity and a breadth of vision about Australia and be prepared to put them on the platform so we can meet them.
Look, there were some really interesting candidates that were selected in South Australia, and I think I took a look at your instruction, Michael, at the inaugural speech of Rod Caddies, the leader of One Nation in Western Australia. He's got a really interesting backstory. So there are a whole range of reasons why people go into politics that are not always the usual ones, I think they'll be after sort of, regular members of the community if they can find them. But I still think it's a big ask from scratch.
A very big ask. Well, you can also do this in reverse. You can get yourself supported by a political party, a well-established political party, get pre-selected for a safe seat in the state parliament in Western Australia, for example, Nedlands. You can be elected and be part of the Liberal movement, part of their front bench, a small front bench, but a front bench. And then suddenly you can say, as Jonathan Huston just has yesterday, well, see you guys. I'm off. I've got my own dreams and responsibilities to my electorate. Seems to me, if not interested in showing the sort of strength of character that One Nation is putting out there, that it's sort of doing what the Community Strong candidates are doing in Sydney, Martin. What's it all about? Is it all crazy? Are you surprised?
I'm a bit surprised. There were a couple of policy differences. I think this Jonathan Huston, the member for Nedlands, he did criticise AUKUS, which is an unusual critique from a Liberal, who've generally been pretty supportive of that. And the latest thing was his call for a bigger mining royalties, which was out of kilter with what Basil Zemplis wanted to see. It doesn't appear to be really clear personality differences between him and the leader, although there does appear to be some tension between him and Liberal Party head office, perhaps. It is a real blow to the Liberals because, just for context, they only had 7 seats in a 59-seat chamber, Michael, in the lower house in Western Australia, and now they've only got 6, which is only on a par with the Nationals. Now, they'll retain official opposition status for now. They lose one more, though, that's under threat. And 6 people, like your lower house is generally where you select your future leaders from. So you've got Basil Zemplis, you've got former Liberal leader Libby Metem, who's a deputy now, and only 4 others. So it's a pretty small pool there. They do have 10 upper house members, Michael, which gives them a front bench to work with. But it's not very many to prosecute the case against the Premier and his senior ministers.
Well, I'm sort of surprised prize that that Jonathan Huston, in his announcement, didn't say he's going over to join the Agrarian Socialists, the Country Party, the National Party, Martin. He seems to me that he wants royalty for regions. He wants a sovereign fund. He wants more money spent on schools and hospitals. He wants to save the poor by building houses for them, and generally, bringing royalties, for regions to the metropolitan area, Martin. Am I being far too cynical and silly?
It's a curious policy mix there, and I wondered about the mining royalties one when you are the member for Netherlands, because I imagine there's a few mining executives that probably live in the seat of Netherlands, Michael, just quietly. Now, for outsiders, Netherlands is, one of the better, more upmarket areas of Perth. So it was a bit of a curious one, and he said that he's going to stand as an independent at the next election. That could be a workable strategy because keep in mind he's in the same area that overlaps with the federal seat of Curtin, which has Kate Chaney. So you've got people that are used to voting for independents now in considerable numbers. So the strategy could work if he gets everything right and reassures voters that he's the real deal.
Well, by all accounts, he has an interesting sort of career background, Martin, including as I think a major in the Australian Army, in intelligence, which all has me wondering whether Andrew Hastie's going to jump the ship for the Libs.
Well, Andrew Hastie has said that he's certainly not jumping the ship for One Nation. And he sort of said he'd rather be martyred than take that particular path. So he's up for the fight, he says. There's still a world in which Andrew Hastie becomes leader. Absolutely a world where that happens. Where, how soon or far is a curiosity. But he's certainly someone that has his own very clear policy agenda that would stack up pretty well against the One Nation tsunami.
Well, Martin, the pipe dream is in all the parties and in the individual loosely connected people, in the New Community Strong Party, in all the little ones that we haven't talked about. There's all sorts of national parties. I lose track of their names, but they're constantly putting their story out. They'll all be working out how they can plug into this, what looks like a very open new political field as we get into the last half of the 2020s, Martin. Between now and the next election, which looks like being in May 2028, what are we going to see? Just more of the same? Lots of navel gazing, lots of pitches to the public?
Well, I think there's still the headline act in Australian politics, like it is in many other democracies, is how far can the populist right go? What strategies can the other parties deploy to keep them at bay? And will the wheel turn eventually, and their support collapse? Because that's the big phenomenon at the moment in Australian politics that's got everyone talking.
Well, Martin, I'm going to go off and I think make a good strong coffee and try and contemplate the significance of all of these events. I'll let you get off to lecturing Notre Dame students about political science. It must be good times for the professionals in the area.
It's never a dull moment, and there's certainly a lot of talking points at the moment. It's a good time to be studying politics.
And our listeners, particularly our regular ones, will be very pleased to realise we haven't mentioned the word starting with T or the other word starting with I or the other ones with P or Z. We leave them. We're much more focused on what happens at 10 o'clock Fremantle time today and whether Australia can at least manufacture a draw with Paraguay. We'll find out, Martin.
Well, I'm sure there'll be plenty of eyes on that this morning.
See you next Friday.
See you soon.